AA, the Greatest Spiritual Movement of the 20th Century Seminar. This is the Saturday afternoon session. Hope everybody, I'm not sure how many people are going to stay awake during this session since we're all full of food and it's warm and the sun's shining, but I'm going to try to stay awake myself. But if I nod off, just let me know. Give me a kick. I want to start off with the four founding moments of AA. In 1979, Ernie Kurtz wrote a book called Not God. It's considered by many to be the most authoritative history ever written on AA. In that book, Ernie describes four seemingly random and unrelated events which together resulted in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. What is truly amazing is that if any one of these events had not taken place, none of us would be here today. Also of interest is that during the course of each event, a message was transmitted that was essential to the development of the AA program. And as I mentioned this morning, there are no coincidences in AA, and what we're going to see here is four moments that I think prove that beyond a shadow of a doubt. And we are going to see the ongoing series of miracles that led to the foundation of this program. But in summary, the four events are, one, a meeting between Dr. Carl Jung and Roland Hazard, which took place in Zurich, Switzerland in September of 1931. Moment number two, a meeting between Roland Hazard and Ebbie Thatcher in Manchester, Vermont in July of 1934, which in turn led to a meeting between Ebbie Thatcher and Bill Wilson on November 25th. 1934, at 182 Clinton Street in Brooklyn, New York. Moment number three, Bill Wilson's spiritual experience at Towns Hospital in New York on December 14th, 1934. And number four, a meeting between Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith at the Cyberling Estate Gatehouse in Akron, Ohio on May 12th. 1935. I'm going to go through each of the events in detail so that you can see for yourselves the miraculous nature of these meetings. The first person I want to talk about is Roland Hazard. That's a little difficult to see, but that is a write-up of Roland the Messenger. I'm going to start with that. This was put together by Ron Ray from Bowling Green, Kentucky. It is as complete a history of Roland Hazard that's been put together to date. It is in the process of being published, or if it hasn't been published yet, it will be soon. But I think this is essential in terms of being able to be here today to explain this to you, how this message got to me. I was talking to Harvey A., the archivist for Los Angeles, on the phone, and he mentioned that a piece had just hit the streets about Roland Hazard. And he told me that the person that he got it from was Clancy I., probably our most well-known circuit speaker in the movement. And he asked me to call Clancy to pick up a copy of it. Well, being, again, relatively new in sobriety, I was a little awestruck by the thought of calling Clancy I. And I wasn't sure he would even be at the Midnight Mission. He kept saying that he worked there, but I didn't know if he really did. But I did. I called the Midnight Mission in downtown Los Angeles, a shelter for the homeless, and I asked for Clancy, and they put me through, and he picked up the phone and said, "Clancy here." I said, "Clancy, I'm a young archivist, new in sobriety from Tucson, Arizona, and I heard that you have some information on Roland the Messenger, and I'd like to know if I could have a copy of it." And he said, "Well, it's not my material, but I'll find out for you. I'll call you back in half an hour. What's your number?" So I gave him my number and hung up the phone and go, "Whew, wow, okay, okay." Never expecting to hear back from him. And a half hour later, I get the phone call, Clancy here. And he gave me the information which allowed me to have this material on Roland to be able to talk about this afternoon. And we do have a few copies of this available, so please see me after the meeting if you'd like one. But Roland Hazard was a young, talented, and wealthy financial wizard. He was born into a socially prominent Rhode Island family whose roots went back 350 years. After graduating from Yale University in 1903, Roland went to work in the business, which consisted of family business, which consisted of woolen mills and chemical plants. In 1920, several of the plants merged to what is now called Allied Chemical. So Roland was on the board of directors of Allied Chemical. That's a pretty heavy-hitting occupation, profession and a position to have. But as the years passed, it became evident that Roland had a problem with alcohol, and in 1929, he was on the verge of losing everything, his stock, his position, his standing in the family. And so Roland checked himself into some of the finest treatment centers in the United States, but he just couldn't stay sober. Because money was not a factor, he finally decided to go to Zurich, Switzerland, and place himself under the care of one of the foremost medical and psychiatric men in the world, Dr. Carl Jung. For close to a year, Roland worked with Dr. Jung, and in the summer of 1931, Dr. Jung pronounced him cured, and Roland returned to the United States. Well, Roland never did make it back to the ship, let alone back to the United States, before he started drinking again. He returned to Zurich, and this time totally defeated, and went to Dr. Jung one more time, his court of last resort. And Dr. Jung told Roland, I originally thought that you were suffering from some deep-seated emotional problem for which I can provide assistance and counsel. But now I realize that you are what we call an alcoholic. And there is absolutely nothing that anyone in either the psychiatric or medical profession can do for you. Your case is hopeless. Roland wasn't too happy with the diagnosis and desperately asked Dr. Jung if there wasn't something he could do. Dr. Jung replied that the only thing that could help him now was a vital spiritual experience. In short, a genuine conversion. Dr. Jung also said that while such experiences had sometimes brought recovery to alcoholics, they were extremely rare. But because there wasn't anything else that Roland could do, he, other than die, he took Carl Jung's advice and he got involved in a spiritual movement. The movement that he chose to become involved in was the Oxford Group. So he returned to New York and joined the group, which was then operating out of the Calgary Church under the direction of Reverend Sam Shoemaker. Roland went to the Oxford Group meetings. He took the Oxford Group four steps. And he became one of the rare cases, maybe the one in 500,000 that had a vital spiritual experience. Roland's spiritual experience occurred while he was driving his car in Massachusetts, when all of a sudden he heard an inner voice say, you will never take a drink again. And Roland remained sober for the rest of his life. And now comes the God part, if that wasn't enough. Carl Jung wasn't Roland Hazard's first choice for psychotherapist. See, there were three world-renowned psychiatrists in 1930. Sigmund Freud, Alfred Adler, and Carl Jung. Roland first tried to see Freud, but Freud was ill in the spring of 1930 and wasn't seeing any new patients. If Roland had been successful in his attempt to see Freud or Adler, we probably wouldn't be here today. Because of the three giants of psychotherapy, only Jung acknowledged and actively worked for a deeper understanding of man's spiritual nature. Freud had little use for religious conversion experiences and even considered them neurotic. Adler was even more ego-centered and believed only in the rationalistic model of human behavior. Therefore, neither Freud nor Adler would have offered Roland a spiritual solution as a means of recovering from alcoholism. But that's the first of our founding moments. In the summer of 1934, Roland was vacationing in Vermont with two of his Oxford Group associates, Seber Graves and Shep Cornwell, when he heard about the plight of one of his elementary school friends, Ebbie Thatcher. It seemed that Ebbie was once again in trouble with the law, and this time he was about to be sent to the state insane asylum for life. And that's Ebbie on the right. That's Bill on the left. It seemed that Ebbie just couldn't stay sober, and while drinking, couldn't stay sober, and when drinking, he couldn't stay out of trouble. So it was the worst of both worlds. This time, Ebbie had driven his car in broad daylight through the side of somebody's house. And part of this may be yarn, but I tell you, it's a good one. The car ended up in the kitchen. Fable, which is where the lady of the house was working. And Ebbie crawled out of the car and asked the woman, "May I trouble you for a cup of coffee?" Well, the woman thought Ebbie was crazy, and so did the judge. So the judge was about to sentence Ebbie to the state insane asylum when Roland intervened. Roland asked the judge to release Ebbie into his custody so that he could take Ebbie to New York and expose him to the Oxford Group. And the judge agreed, and Roland took Ebbie to New York. Ebbie stayed sober through the fall of 1934 and worked his Oxford Group steps. When he was asked to witness for the Oxford Group, he called the only person he knew in New York who was worse off than he was, and that was Bill Wilson. But before I get to that meeting with Bill, I want to take a couple minutes and talk about Towns Hospital, which is where Bill ended up. Bill had already been through Towns Hospital three times when Ebbie made that call. What I found out, and this is Mitchell Kay's book, who brought his archival collection, but he was kind enough to provide me with this on a loan basis so I could make a copy of it. It's one of the few, I don't know if there are any more out there, I don't know if anybody else that has one. Again, a very rare book. But a lot of people talk about William Silkworth and the immense knowledge that he had about alcoholism. Well, what I found out by reading this is that Charlie Towns actually was the source of much of that information. In this Habits That Handicap, written by Charlie Towns in 1915, he goes into quite a bit of detail on the disease concept of alcoholism and how drug addictions of all sorts can be cured by working a regimen, by taking action. That was one of the things that Charlie Towns believed in, that you had to take actions in order to recover. And Charlie also followed that up in 1931 with a second book called Reclaiming the Drinker. This one's so rare, I've never even seen an original. A copy of this was sent to me graciously by a gentleman, Gary G. in Milton, New Hampshire. And he made a copy of it for me. And again, it confirms that Charlie Towns did have a great deal of insight into working with alcoholics. The Towns Hospital was actually a country club by comparison. He catered to the rich and the elite, and it took them through treatment sometimes within 3 and 5 days. Was able to physically get people off of alcohol through the use of various drugs, none of which are being used today. Quite dangerous, actually. But Charlie was most fortunate that Silkworth went to work for Charlie in 1930 and learned a lot from Charlie so he could carry that message on to Bill. There was another message that was carried. But getting back to Ebbie's story, on November 25th, 1934, Ebbie called on Bill at his home in 182 Clinton Street in Brooklyn, New York. Ebbie was 3 months sober and Bill was drunk. Ebbie told Bill about the hopelessness of his life and the changes that had taken place since joining the Oxford Group. He touched on the subject of prayer and God and told Bill that the new God consciousness had released him from the desire to drink and had given him peace of mind and a happiness of a kind he had not known for years. Well, Bill wasn't too thrilled with the message and continued to drink after Ebby's visit. But something must have stuck because 2 weeks later, Bill went back to Towns Hospital to dry out for the fourth time that year. He checked in on November 11th, 1934, and shortly thereafter had a spiritual awakening. That is the third founding moment of AA. Bill called this experience his hot flash. And his description was quite vivid. He said, "Suddenly the room lit up with a great white light. It seemed as though I was on a mountain and a wind of the Spirit was blowing. And then it burst upon me that I was a free man. I thought to myself, so this is the God of the preachers." Well, Ebby brought Bill a copy of the Varieties of Religious Experience the next day. When Bill started to read about sudden conversion experiences, he realized that that's what he'd had the day before. Bill also learned from Ebby that he couldn't keep what he had unless he worked with others, just as Roland had worked with Ebby, and Ebby had worked with him. Now it was Bill's turn to carry the message. So Bill set out to save drunks. In fact, he once said that his mission in life was to save all the drunks in the world. He worked with them at Towns Hospital and at the Calvary Mission. Oops, and there's Silkworth, and there's the Towns Hospital. Okay. He took them home and gave them food and a place to stay. It was estimated that he worked with as many as 40 alcoholics through the winter and spring of 1935, but not one of them stayed sober. By the end of April, Bill was ready to give it up, and that's when Lois came to our rescue and saved a fellowship. One night, Bill was pretty down, and he said, "Lois, I'm ready to pack it in. I thought I'd received something, a gift in Towns Hospital, but whatever it was, it doesn't seem to be working because I haven't helped a single alcoholic." And that's when Lois said, "Bill, it must be working because you've been sober for 5 months, and you've never been able to stay sober before." That important lesson gave Bill the information that he needed, that it didn't matter whether anybody else received the message. Just by carrying the message, a person could stay sober because he was proof positive that that was happening. Just by trying to carry the message, Bill was staying sober. A couple of weeks later, Bill traveled to Akron, Ohio, on a business deal. And when the deal fell through, Bill was depressed and broke. He knew that he would drink again if he didn't find another alcoholic to talk to, and the other alcoholic turned out to be Dr. Bob Smith. And that meeting took place on May 12, 1935. And that's our fourth founding moment. But I do want to spend a couple of minutes in terms of how that meeting took place. Bill was in the Mayflower Hotel with $10 in his pocket. He didn't even have the money to return to New York. The business deal had fallen through. The rest of the financial people that he was working with had already left. They left Bill behind to see if he could salvage the deal. There wasn't any way to salvage it, and he actually didn't even have the money to return. So while he was in the Mayflower Hotel, he was looking at the list of ministers and came across the name of Reverend Tunks and called Reverend Tunks. The slide before that was the church where Reverend Tunks actually was the minister of, the Episcopal Church. And when he called Tunks, Tunks gave him 10 names. There are several stories on this too, but I'm going to give the one that I've heard the most. And that is he called all 10 names. Now, I'm not even sure if I would have called one or two, but he called all 10 and was rejected by the 9 out of the 10. Either they weren't alcoholics, or they didn't care, or they were busy. But the 10th one is the person that gave him the phone number of Henrietta Seiberling. So Henrietta Seiberling's name wasn't even on the list. But because he was persistent enough to go through the first nine. And the tenth person he called said, I'm leaving town. I don't have time to talk, but I do know somebody that may be able to help you, and that's Henrietta Seiberling. Well, Henrietta, Bill recognized the name Seiberling, and he wasn't really interested in calling her because of thinking that she was just far too prominent. And so he returned to his room, and these are all photographs of the Mayflower Hotel, just taken in the last couple of years. But he did, from that church directory, get the name of Henrietta Seiberling, went up to his room, thought about it, prayed about it, came down and made the call, and that famous rum hound from New York story, which Henrietta does not substantiate, but Henrietta does substantiate that he called. And she was delighted because she had been working with Dr. Bob for quite some time, and Dr. Bob, for 2.5 years, actually. And nothing had transpired except Dr. Bob continued to drink. We have, and the next one. But then that meeting took place on May 12th of 1935, was arranged by Henrietta, because Henrietta called over to Ann Smith's house because her and Ann had been in the Oxford group since 1933. Dr. Bob started going to meetings late in 33. But Henrietta called Ann and said that she was in contact with a man that she thought could help Dr. Bob. And Dr. Bob was in no condition to go to that meeting, so they had to beg off and had to postpone the meeting for a day for Dr. Bob to sober up. That's about a shape he was in. But when that meeting took place at the Seiberling Estate, which is part of Stan Hewitt, meeting, which was to originally have lasted 15 minutes, turned out to be a five-hour meeting. What had happened is Dr. Bob, Smitty drove the car. Sue had a date, so she begged off. She didn't want to go over, but it was just Smitty, Ann, and Dr. Bob driving over to the Seiberling guest house. And Dr. Bob told Smitty and Ann, he said, I only want 15 minutes with this guy. Get me out of there. But as soon as they sat down together, and I think Bill's first words were, you sure look like you could use a drink. That got Bob's attention. A little shaky, huh? And he was a lot shaky. But Bill told his story. As Silkworth had explained to him earlier, please leave out the religious conversion, the conversion experience. Try to stick to the medical and the physical and the emotional aspects of it, and bring in the spiritual later. It's amazing. Dr. Bob, being a medical doctor of many years, had never heard this explanation of alcoholism being an allergy of the body and a compulsion of the mind, obsession of the mind. He'd never heard alcoholism described in that way, and he described later, Dr. Bob did, that Bill knew exactly what he was talking about. Here I was talking with a man that knew about alcohol, and that's why they talked for 5 hours. Well, after that meeting, Bill was put up temporarily at the golf course by Henrietta in Akron. Because he was totally broke, Anne took pity upon him and invited him home to spend some time with Dr. Bob. And Bill moved in and stayed for 3 months. But it was the most dramatic 3 months of our fellowship, because during those 3 months is when Bill really learned about the spiritual aspects of the program from Anne. Anne's really, Bill even described her as the mother of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was Anne that actually took Bill down on his knees and into the surrender, and taught him about the morning meditation and the quiet time and the guidance and the Bible readings and the meditations. That mostly came from Ann Smith. But they realized that they wouldn't be able to stay sober if they didn't work with somebody else. Oh, this is all part of the how the meetings were conducted. That's the official coffee pot from the first meeting. And the next one is Bill D, AA number 3, on the left. What Dr. Bob and Bill found, especially after Dr. Bob's slip, he went off to a convention in Atlantic City because of the medical convention, and he never signed in. He was drunk the entire time, came back on a Thursday, and they poured him off the train, and Bill and Ann worked with him all weekend because he had an operation to perform on Monday. And he did perform that operation. After that operation, he did not return home. He realized that he needed to work the program. He needed to take the action, and he went out and made all of his restitutions, as many as he could do, in one afternoon, and Dr. Bob never drank again. But they also realized that there was just two of them. They needed a third one, and so they kept searching the Akron City Hospital. About 2 weeks later, after a couple of false starts, Bill D., who was a lawyer, who had drunk himself out of the legal profession, was in the hospital. He'd been in 6 times in 6 months. He was strapped down, and Bill and Bob went to talk to him. And Bill Dodson's first question was, how much is this thing going to cost? And when they said it was nothing, that they were doing that to save their own lives, Bill said, the least I could do is listen. They weren't trying to ram anything down my throat, but they told me that if I listened to them, it would help keep them sober, and I did. And Bill Dodson never had another drink after that either. And so there were three, and from the three, we now have 2 million. So that's how it all began. And after they'd been working with Rummies, what they called Rummies, for 2 years, in late 1937, they had 40, and they decided that it was time to actually write down their experiences, and that's how the Big Book came to be, and that'll be the next section. The writing of the Big Book. Oh, no, I do want to close with one statement. Now, this is a controversial statement, but I think it's absolutely classic, because it came from Sam Shoemaker. I don't try to put either Bill or Bob or Clarence or any of these people on pedestals. They were just drunks like us. Nobody ran around in the 1930s with halos. And Sam Shoemaker, I think, knew Bill Wilson as well as anybody. And with Bill Wilson on the podium in 1960, this is what Sam Shoemaker had to say about this entire early period of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is from Sam. Sometimes God can take the mistaken and the egotistical drives of a person and slowly refine these things until they are of great use to him and of great use to humanity. That's what happened to Bill. He thought he was the Messiah, and he had to get this thing across to all the drunks in the world. And I'm kind of glad he was so egotistical and driven, because he didn't let up until he did save as many of the drunks as he could before he died in 1971. But let's go ahead and take a break after this, and then we'll come back in just say 10 minutes, just a short break, and we'll pick it up with the writing of the Big Book. Okay, welcome back after that short break. Now we're going to pick up our history in terms of the writing of the Big Book and the early publicity surrounding the evolution of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to take a few minutes to talk about our history in terms of the miraculous chain of events that led up to the development of the program. And one of those is that the Big Book itself. I do believe that this Big Book, this book, is divinely inspired and divinely written. And the reason I say that is because Bill Wilson did not know enough to write this book. And I'm saying that because he was just 2.5 years sober. and he had never written anything before in his life. He didn't have a religious background, didn't have a psychological background, or a medical background, or a philosophical background. He was just a Wall Street speculator, stock wheeler-dealer, did a little bit of brokering. And he ended up writing one of the most spiritual books that's ever been written. And I want to start by describing the books that Bill Wilson used as reference material to write this book. And I want to start there is because I've read this reference material. And there's no way with the reference material that Bill Wilson had that he could have written this book either. But this is where some of the ideas came from that Bill used to write this book. The first book that he used was Twice Born Men by Harold Bigby. It was written in 1909, and this book had to do with the way some people were trying to sober up alcoholics within the Salvation Army. This book was written on the Salvation Army. The reason that this book is of interest is because the beginning of the book contained a very limited program of recovery, and the back of the book contained stories of people who had recovered. And this is where the big book format came from. Program of recovery in the front, stories in the back. And another book that Bill Wilson used, of course, is What is the Oxford Group? But before I get into that one, I'm going to touch on the varieties of religious experience that that Bill used. This was provided to him by Ebby the day after his spiritual experience in Towns Hospital. This book is a hard read for anybody that's into the literature. This is not an easy book to get through. I'm not sure Bill really read it with 2 days of sobriety. But there aren't any pictures either, so he must have done something. But you can get a good overview of the story after story after story of people that did have sudden conversion experiences. I did learn from this book that there are two ways to have conversion experiences. Either through great knowledge or great pain. That's the message that I got from this book. Great knowledge, that leaves a lot to be desired, but the great pain, certainly, I'm well familiar with that. Another book that Bill Wilson used was This Believing World. This was written by Lewis Brown. Very controversial book at the time. What he'd done is he'd taken all the religions of the world and he'd summarized their belief systems and their dogma and their ritual and came to the conclusion when you strip all of that away that there is only one higher power and that we are truly one. There are many rooms in this mansion. Another book that Bill used was Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. We talked about that earlier in terms of the New Thought movement. Emmett Fox did have a theological background and was preaching from hotel ballrooms, but Bill and Lois would go and listen to him on Saturday nights. And he would talk about universal love and cosmic consciousness and that became the higher power that Bill believed in, was this this God of universal love. And another book that Bill used was The Common Sense of Drinking by Richard Peabody. And we talked about that in terms of the Emmanuel movement. And again, as I mentioned earlier, Bill paraphrased some of this book, not outright plagiarized. On page 84, it says, "This is the absolute starting point." Page 82, once a drunkard, always a drunkard. And on page 99, a man must make up his mind to do everything in his power to cooperate in such work as there is to be done. Halfway measures are of no avail. So Bill did quite a bit of research, did quite a bit of reading in terms of writing the book. In terms of the Oxford Group book, we did talk about the Oxford Group Four Steps, so he did have that as a background. He did have an additional background from the Oxford Group that I want to read, and that's the first paragraph, which became part of our preamble, it almost sounds like. And this is from the Oxford Group book. And see how close this sounds to the foreword to our book. You cannot belong to the Oxford Group. It has no membership list, subscriptions, badge, rules, or definite location. It is a name for a group of people who from every rank, profession, and trade in many countries have surrendered their lives to God and who are endeavoring to lead a spiritual quality of life under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. The Oxford Group is not a religion. It has no hierarchy, no temples, no endowments. Its workers have no salaries, no plans but God's plan. Every country is their country, every man their brother. They are holy crusaders in modern dress, wearing spiritual armor. Their aim is a new world order for Christ the King. That's right from the Oxford Group. But Bill started writing this book in the spring of 1938. In fall of 37 is when he met with Dr. Bob, and they decided to write the book. The two of them sat down, and they came up with 40 people that had had at least attended meetings. Not that they were, that many of them were sober, but at least they were attending. Most of them, in terms of coming and going, were going. But they did have 40 names and thought that maybe they might have something. So Bill wanted to write down what it was they thought they had so that it couldn't be diluted in the generations yet to come. Didn't know if they had it, but they didn't want it changed or diluted just in case they did have something. And after Bill had gotten two chapters completed, he wrote his story, and there is a solution. He took them down to Harper's Publishing Company, and an editor said to him, "Mr. Wilson, do you think you can finish this book?" And Bill said, "Sure." And the editor said, "We'd like to give you $1,500 advance as an incentive to do so." Well, Bill was ecstatic. $1,500. Here's a man that hadn't worked for 10 years. Lois was supporting him, had been supporting him for quite some time. And here was a publishing company offering him $1,500. Well, he took this offer back to the group. This is interesting, too. They didn't just accept it on the spot. He took the offer back to the group, and he brought it to their attention. And it's interesting to see that the group conscience was certainly not Bill's conscience because the drunk said, well, one of them, especially Hank Parkhurst, said, "Bill, if there's $1,500 in it for you, there must be millions in it for us. Let's publish the book ourselves." So this is the brainstorm that led to the Works Publishing, Inc., this corporation was put together primarily by Hank Parkhurst because Hank had a good working background in this area. He was an ex-oil company executive. He had drunk his way out of that job, but he did have a solid business background. And so Hank formed this corporation, and they started selling stock certificates so that they could get this book published. And Peter does have an original stock certificate on display as part of the archives. It's one of the few I've ever seen. But that stock certificate has a lot of significance to it. Number one, it came with a prospectus, and this is how they were selling them. But the but more importantly is that it said that. And this one says it too, is that it's incorporated under the laws of the state of New York. Well, they never went down and incorporated this company. So they could have done serious time for issuing phony stock certificates. Never found a record of this corporation being recorded. But those are the stock certificates, par value $25. And this is the deal. It came with a prospectus. And what they had done is they had determined a return on investment scheme here. And I want to read that to you, because what's going up on the screen is a little too hard to read. In the prospectus, this was how it worked. Okay, you give Works Publishing Company $25, and they give you that beautiful green certificate with a guarantee. I mean, they knew they were going to sell a bunch of books. So they set out with minimums and maximums. They thought they could sell several hundred thousand. But the breaks were, if they sold 100,000 books in the first year, you would get your $25 back plus $150. That's a significant return on investment. If they only sold 50,000 books, you got your original investment back plus $75. If they sold 25,000 books, you got your original investment back plus $30. And if they only sold 15,000 books, I mean, that's rock bottom minimum, you still got your money back and $10. So that was the deal, and that's what's over here in the profit. No, that's actually the profit and loss statement, but the next one would have the one more. Let's see if that's in there. Nope, I have to back up because that's not in there. But the profits and losses statement does have it in there. Yeah, there it is right there. I'm sorry. In the lower right-hand column. That's the deal. So what happened is they sold about $2,500 worth of stock to various people to get this thing going. Ruth Hawk, who was Hank P's secretary at the time, was doing all the typing for the big book, and she was being paid with one stock certificate a week. What a deal. One stock certificate a week. But to tell you just how valuable these stock certificates were, the minimum return was based on 15,000 sales, and they sold less than 200 books the first year. So these were worthless stock certificates. Unregistered and worthless. And, I'm sorry, they sold $4,600 in stock. That's a lot of... Bill was sure a mover and a shaker. And they did receive a $2,500 loan from Charlie Towns, who we talked about earlier, Towns Hospital. So Bill continued to write, and actually he dedicated the book to Ruth from notes that he had made. Dictated the book to Ruth from notes that he'd made. The chapters weren't even written down. So Bill was pacing up and down the floor, and Ruth was doing the dictating. Go ahead and move to... we'll move one more beyond that. Oops, two more. Nope, we'll have to back up. Okay. I thought I had these in sequence, but obviously I've got a few of them out of order. But I did want to... go back to that then. The name of the corporation they formed was 100 Men, and the title of the book was 100 Men. And that is on the slide. The next one from that one, go right ahead. There it is. If you look up in the upper left-hand corner, it says the 100 Men Corporation. The purpose, to publish the book 100 Men. That was the working title of this book. And it remained the working title until late 1938. And what's amazing here is that two people influenced the final book title. The first one was Florence Rankin. She stumbled into the rooms late in 1938. She was one of the first women to attempt to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. What's amazing is that she stayed sober just long enough to get the name of the book changed. She started drinking again in 39, and she died drunk, but she stayed sober just long enough to get the name of the book changed. And at one of the meetings, she said, "You cannot call this book 100 Men. I'm here. I want you to call this book 100 Men and One Woman." Well, Bill and the guys didn't take to that too kindly, but they also realized that they couldn't call the book 100 Men either. So they did go out searching for a new name. And some of the names that were being circulated at the time, the Way Out, The Empty Glass, The Dry Frontier, the Bill W. Movement, I wonder where that one came from. So the printers, when Joe Wearden happened to attend one meeting, and one meeting only, and that's Joe. Probably the only photograph that anybody has of Joe. He was the past editor of the New Yorker magazine, but he drunk himself into oblivion. He had a wet brain, and he was committed to the state insane asylum. But some of the staff at the asylum had heard about Bill working with alcoholics, and they released him so that he could go to a meeting. He got drunk after the meeting, and it was the only meeting he attended. But during that meeting, he said, and this is part of the the folklore. This meeting that he attended, the following transpired, that he said, "I hear you're talking about all these names for a book. Why don't you name the book after yourselves? Why don't you call it something like Anonymous Alcoholics? Because that's what you are. You're all trying to remain anonymous, and you're all alcoholics. Anonymous Alcoholics." Well, silence, and I said, "Well, how about Alcoholics Anonymous?" And Bill replied, "Alcoholics Anonymous what?" And Joe said, "Alcoholics Anonymous period." And that's where the period came from in our first edition big book. I also think that this is significant enough that I make the statement that because of this tradition, that the unofficial title of this book is Alcoholics Anonymous period, and was from 1939 to 1955, that I announced myself as an alcoholic period in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just part of our history. Don't think anything else needs to be said, just like Joe said. Alcoholics Anonymous, period. Well, the title of the book hadn't really been decided upon, but they sent down to Fitz Mayo, who was in Maryland, working out of Washington D.C., and he was AA number 3 in New York, but spending quite a bit of time in the D.C. area, that they sent him down to check out the various titles in the Library of Congress. And this is Fitz's house in Cumberstone. A lot of the book was actually written here, we find out, that Bill would travel, as we heard from Jim, Bill would travel down to this area, stay at Fitz's house on the weekends, and work on the book, and attend Oxford group meetings. While it was still the Oxford group, and then stayed with Fitz in that house on the weekends, writing the book up until it was completed. But the message went down to Fitz to check in with the Library of Congress, and he sent back a telegram that read, in terms of the various titles, 25 titles, The Way Out, 12, The Way, 0, Alcoholics Anonymous. Some people hear that there was 12 and they didn't want 13 of The Way Out, but this is what the actual telegram reads. I have seen the telegram. 25, The Way Out, 12, The Way, 0, Alcoholics Anonymous. So hopefully that'll help set the record straight. In terms of... this is where these slides are. In terms of where the book was written, this is 17 William Street in Newark, New Jersey. When Bill wasn't working at Cumberstone in Maryland, this was the office of Hank P., and it was Honor Dealers was the company that he had started, and they were selling automobile polish out of the sixth floor. And this is what it looked like a couple years ago. It's a trashed out area of Newark, New Jersey. It's in the process of being demolished. This is one of the last trips that anybody made through this particular building. And I did want to just show you a piece of our history that is being lost, that has been lost. Just like the Wilson House was almost lost, if you see the beginning photographs, the before photographs. There are no after photographs of 17 William Street. Here we are getting ready to trudge in. It was actually boarded up. We had to break in. So we got the barricades down, and here we're going in. This is the Calumet Building on 17 William Street. And this is the office. This is the entrance, what it looks like, completely deteriorated, completely destroyed just by age. This is where the office was for Honor Dealers. Oh, that's an upside down one. You got to help these guys. And wanted to show that because that's the gentleman that actually gave us the tour, Merton M. from he's a New Jersey archivist, and he is writing the book on Hank Parkhurst. And here we are. We finally made it alive to the sixth floor. This is the actual office. You can see the ceiling falling down, and we kept looking. Every time Merton went in, he kept looking for the lost stash of big books. We broke into one of the closets looking for books, but what we realized is that this is actually the closet where what few books they had were being stored at the time, because there were little shelves just for the big books, and it was right at the edge of the office. It's the only shelf space they had. But we never found the lost cash, and we never found the 400 missing pages. We sure looked hard though. But that's a piece of our history that has been lost. The building is in total ruin, and if it hasn't been demolished by now, it will be. So I'm so glad that at least we have the photographs to show you of where the book was actually written. It was written in a very small office. Shortly after the book was published, they couldn't even maintain the rent on the building, and they were forced to vacate it. They were actually thrown out of there. But getting back to the book itself, it's amazing that we came so close to this book being called 100 Men. And this book even comes with three references to the original title. If you look at a first edition, first printing, on the title page, it does say the story of how 100 men have recovered from alcoholism. And if you look at There is a Solution, which in the first edition would be starting on page 27, because the doctor's opinion was part of the book and was numbered. It wasn't a preface. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know 100 men who are just as hopeless as Bill. And the back of the dust jacket does say the story of how 100 men have recovered from alcoholism. They didn't have time. It was so close to publication that they made it as many changes as they could, and they actually just missed a few, I believe. But if this book had been published, 100 Men, I'm not sure if anybody would have bought it. And I don't know if any of us would be here today, but thank God that Florence Rankin and Joe Wearden interceded in our behalf and had the book, the name of the book changed. And then, here's another one of the miracles. When Bill talks about 100 men, they weren't even close to 100 men. When the book was published, this is one of the controversies that I'm involved in right now. The most we've come up with that even ever attended a meeting between 1935 and 1939 were 68 to 72. That's how many names we have. And when the book was published in April 1939, there was only somewhere between 12 and 18 people with more than 1 year of sobriety. I mean, this truly was a shot in the dark. Only between 12 and 18 people with a year of sobriety when this book was published. And these are the people that helped write it. Bill was the old timer with 2.5 years. The early publicity started off with an opportunity to do a little radio advertising for the book. It was Gabriel Heater's radio show, We the People, and some contacts were made, and Morgan Ryan was going to be the speaker. Morgan's the one who set it up, and Morgan only had a couple months of sobriety. And this is a classic story in that from two standpoints. One is the last $500 of all the money that had been contributed went to these postcards to send out all over the country advertising the book, because the book hadn't been selling, and now it's April, and they realize that or it's later in the summer. Let's see. Oh, it was actually April 25th, so it was just after the book was published. This was our first publicity. And they expected that they would get thousands of orders, so they sent out thousands of postcards advertising this. Then they became quite apprehensive about Morgan only being a couple months sober, so they locked him up in a hotel room for a week to keep him from going out drinking before the radio broadcast. I mean, how much of this stuff could you get away with today? I mean, but they did. They locked him up, and they put him under 24-hour guard. And when he showed up to do We the People, he was sober. I'm not sure how happy he was, but he was sober. And let's see, they actually had him. One of the prosperous newcomers had a membership in the Downtown Athletic Club. If we paid charges, could a double room be arranged? Grumbling loudly, Morgan was conducted into captivity. So they actually had him at the Downtown Athletic Club. Oh, glorious, glorious stuff. And what happened after that was again, a humbling experience. They'd sent out thousands of postcards. They waited for the postcards to come back with all these book orders. And when they went down to the P.O. box, there was only 12 cards. And of the 12 cards, most of them had been written by people who were obviously drunk because you couldn't read them. And there were only two orders for the book. Their last $500, and they got two orders for the book. So now they really were bankrupt. I mean, this is also part of the miracle, just how they survived after writing this book with the phony stock certificates. They had loans out to Charlestown's and others, and now they had no money and no means of repaying it because nobody was buying the book. And that's when they actually hit upon a gentleman by the name of Bert Taylor, who was a tailor.